Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Strategy Hero podcast, the podcast that's all about diving into the world of business strategy, transformation, and operational excellence. With people from all walks of life, today we have a very special guest, someone that I'm really excited to talk to, Ryan Henson. Ryan, how are you?
Hi, James. Yes, I'm very well and really excited to talk to you and it's a real privilege to be invited on.
The feeling is mutual, Ryan. So everyone, Ryan's background is in international development, social mobility, and politics. Right now, he's the CEO of the Coalition for Global Prosperity and serves as the UK government's appointed social mobility commissioner. He's also a military reservist and an Aspen UK Rising Leaders Fellow, which, you know, there's so much that we can talk about, Ryan, but to get started, as with every episode, I would love if you could just give a very short introduction to your career, how you got into those, into this space, and you know, then we can dive into today's topic.
Yeah, sure. Well, I had an unusual route into what I'm doing now. I left school when I was 16. I didn't have any qualifications. I worked in a pub for a few years. And it was before the financial crash in 2007. So I managed to get a job in the civil service doing admin. It's a lot harder now to get in. I think you need degrees and qualifications, and it's just hard even with all that stuff. But I somehow got in, and that really opened my mind to a different world, a world completely different to the one that my parents had sort of existed in and I had existed in. And I got interested in politics. So from there, I decided to go back to school, did some A-levels, got into university. And then once I had my degree, I thought, how do I help people who are in my shoes? And I sort of stumbled on politics as the route by which to do it. And so I went to work for a member of parliament. I got interested in international development. It was around the time of the refugee crisis. I mean, it's been one permanent crisis, but it came to public attention in 2016. And so from there, I went to work for a big international development organization called CAFOD. But I always had in the back of my mind the social mobility stuff too. Very conscious that I got very lucky in some ways. And I wanted to make sure that you didn't need to rely on luck in order to get on, no matter where you came from, no matter what your background was, no matter what your parents did for a living. And so I've ended up now running an organization which advocates on behalf of the international development sector, campaigns for British leadership in international development, and also the social mobility role, which you mentioned at the beginning, James. I'm still interested in politics, stood for Parliament in 2019, so had a bit of an adventure there. But that's in a nutshell how I got to where I am now.
So to give everyone a peek behind the curtain, so to speak, when Ryan and I were talking about topics for today's episode, I spoke to Ryan and talked about how my background, especially my education in terms of my master's education, was in human rights and international development law, and we found a bit of a connection there. For me, my interest has always come from quite similar to you, Ryan, in the sense of there's some level of inability to access certain careers, certain education, certain things that I believe that fundamentally we should all be able to at least access. How did you find yourself gravitating towards social mobility?
In total truth, it was because I had a chip on my shoulder. Which is quite negative, but it is the truth, and it's a lot different now. But when I was in the civil service, I sat next to someone with 2 degrees, and our line manager had not only gone to Oxford but had also been the University Challenge Oxford. I don't know. I don't watch that show, but he was like the team captain or whatever.
Yeah.
And they really inspired me, actually. So that's the positive. But the negative was, and this was less common in the civil service and more when I started engaging with politics, was I'd meet people in quite senior positions or positions of influence or just people who had a lot to say. And I sort of concluded after a while, once I'd come to terms with the imposter syndrome, a lot of them didn't know what they were talking about. And that's not the end of the world, but they would often pontificate on issues of poverty or what it was like to grow up on a council estate. I would think to myself, I don't think you've ever been to a council estate. I don't think you've ever met a poor person before. And yet you've got this position in part because of the upbringing that you've had or the education that you've had. And I'm really envious of that. And I, you know, why can't I say what I want to say and get immersed in these debates too? And I just didn't have the intellectual confidence. I didn't have the social confidence. And I put a lot of that down to the lack that I've had personally and the fortune that others have had. And so I moved towards social mobility for that reason. I've since gone on something of a journey. I mean, we're going back 20 years when I first started having these feelings, and I'm now significantly older and lived a bit. And I suppose where I am now is that it's not that I want to pull people down, and I no longer feel envious of those who have been fortunate to get a good education. But what I want is to raise the bar for everyone else and bring them up to a decent level. So, but anyway, but that's the answer to your question. Yeah, I had a chip on my shoulder, and it's still there. It still pops up occasionally, but I'm aware of it now, so I can bat it back down to some extent.
I think if our listeners were honest with themselves, and I feel this way about myself as well, if I looked in the mirror, I would agree with what you say there, Ryan, in terms of it's easy to develop a chip on your shoulder when you feel that, people around you perhaps don't have the experience of doing the doing, but end up, or even just the experience of what they're talking about, in whatever regards that might be. It's difficult to reconcile perhaps that chip on your shoulder with, okay, well, perhaps there's something that I can do, and seeing how your career path potentially could go from there. And I think for our listeners, I'm sure there are plenty of you that perhaps feel that leadership doesn't necessarily have the experience that you've got from working on the shop floor, for instance, or in different plants. But it's important that you're able to find a way to deal with that sort of chip on your shoulder and do something productive with it. What was the process for you, Ryan, in terms of thinking, okay, well, I have a bit of an issue here. I think there's a disconnect between what this person's saying and what this person has experienced. How did you deal with that, mentally?
Yeah, well, it was hard, and there was no clear path forward. So I suppose looking back, it looks like there's been a clear path, but at no point did I ever consciously sit down and think, right, this is what I'm going to do. I sort of stumbled along in the dark to some extent. But I think making sense of it, I acknowledged to myself that just because this person perhaps doesn't know what they're talking about or is in their position because they've been fortunate in, the circumstances of their birth, doesn't necessarily give me a God-given right to weigh in either. Like, I also need to know what I'm talking about, and I can talk to my lived experience, but you know what? At the same time, I grew up in the southeast of England. I'm a white male. I'm also pretty privileged. There's a lot of people out there who've also had a tough time, worse than me. So how do I get qualified to talk about these issues? And that's one of the reasons, the main reason I went to university to sort of try and educate myself. I mean, I left school without any qualifications. What I didn't say is that I wasn't untypical. At the school I went to, most people left without very many qualifications. So I felt that I needed to go and sort of get some knowledge. And I also knew that I needed to get some life experience, which is why I got that without wanting it. I was washing up in a pub full time. I could have done without that, but I sort of felt that that's one bit of life experience, but it doesn't compare to lots of other things. So I felt that I needed to go off and educate myself. And I think it's definitely a lifelong journey. I mean, everything is when it comes to this sort of thing, but I think it's been a case of, well, where can I have the most impact according to my skills? If I was if I don't know, if I was th this way inclined and I had my brain worked in this sort of way, I might go into AI or engineering and try and reconcile this issue in that area, but I was always drawn to politics. I was always quite interested in it, and so I saw politics as a way to get this sort of debate into the national consciousness, talk about these issues, and as I've got more experience in my career, I've also been able to provide governance support as well. So on the Social Mobility Commission, half of that role is lending experience to the team of officials who work so hard on this day in, day out. But I'm always looking for avenues to work on this topic. But that's where I've got to at the moment.
I think just as an aside, I think everyone should have some sort of role that involves working in retail or with people at the beginning of their career. For me, I worked in a grocery store, and that was about 18 months, and that was eye-opening, and I think gave me the chance to broaden my horizons that perhaps university or my upbringing necessarily hadn't given me. When you talk about knowledge and experience, it leads me naturally onto talking about the Coalition for Global Prosperity. How does your work as a Social Mobility Commissioner fit into the CGP, and what is the story of the CGP?
Well, the coalition was set up 5.5 years ago, and I came on board just under 4 years ago. So basically, what was happening was we went through a golden period of international development in the UK. So if you think back to Live Aid, if you think back to the turn of the millennium, the big debate in politics at the time, pre 9/11 and pre the financial crash, was we've won the Cold War, living standards are rising, war is a thing of the past. The next big challenge before climate change came to everyone's mind, is how do we lift people out of poverty in places like Africa and Asia? That was the big thing. It may not have been in the consciousness of the man on the street, but the political elite certainly were thinking about this. And as time has gone on, it's gone from being like a positive to a negative. So after the 9/11 and the sort of focus on terrorism, after the financial crash and the tightening of belts, both at a sort of macro political level and at a household budget level, the sort of thinking went, well, we can't afford to give this anymore. And actually, we should look after our own at home. We've got problems in the UK. We should fix the high streets. We should invest in hospitals and all that, all legitimate things. But this then went to an opposite extreme. So by the time you got to 2015, the Daily Mail, the Sun, tabloid newspapers were running regular stories saying the aid budget is being wasted. It's all going to corrupt dictators. None of it works anyway. And blah, 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 blah. And some of those challenges were legitimate. You know, spending taxpayers' money, you should always ensure that every penny goes directly to those who need it. But it got to a point where public opinion had shifted dramatically, which meant that political opinion had shifted, and we were at risk of perhaps not spending anything on international development. And the consequences of that would have been a huge rise in poverty, which affects us in the UK. Like, you know, if COVID has taught us anything, it's that viruses, pandemics, they don't stay where they are, they travel. And if there's a war in Yemen or a war in Syria, that means there's going to be a refugee crisis in Europe. It just the world's too interconnected. So anyway, that's the backdrop. But the coalition was set up to make the positive case for international development, but not in a way that had been made before, because that clearly wasn't working. Wheeling out Bono and all these celebrities to say, give your money, you know, and all of that. People are fed up with that. So we were set up to sort of say, look, this is in our national interest. You may not want to give money to people overseas because, you know, you've got enough going on at home. But actually, if you want to create the trading partners of the UK in the future, which boosts our economy, development's a good thing. If you don't want the UK to be dragged into another situation like the war in Afghanistan because it was a failed state, why not invest in states before they fail? So that we don't have to go over there and send our troops in future years. If you look at where terrorism comes from, the biggest external threat to the UK on a terrorist sort of front is from Al-Shabaab, which mostly operates in East Africa. East Africa is going through one of the worst droughts and hunger crises in generations. The link is so clear and obvious. So we sort of make those arguments, which you typically won't hear from Oxfam, Save the Children, Christian Aid. But we felt there was a space to make those arguments. And we specialize in giving a platform to faith leaders, military leaders, business leaders, the type of people who, if you're skeptical of spending money on development, you're going to look at what they say and think twice because they're not your typical aid advocates. So that's why we're set up, and that's broadly what we do.
So something you mentioned there, Ryan, about and these are my words, not yours. When there's a good purpose behind a message that's perhaps hard for the majority to hear and to deal with, what goes into the effort? What are the sort of tactics that you would use to be able to change those minds and win those hearts?
Yeah, so I mean, we mostly deal with or target policymakers. There are really good organizations out there which work on public opinion, but we mostly stick with policymakers. But of course, there's overlap, and I will do media which, gets watched by the general public as well. And I always think there's two main arguments that we try and land. One is the moral argument. And I use the moral argument because I feel so strongly about it, and therefore I feel like I'm authentic when I talk about it. And if you don't have authenticity, you're going to get found out. So I don't get out of bed in the morning and do this job because I want to help Britain create the trading partners of the future. I mean, that's good stuff. I mean, I'm all for that. I'm not against it, but it doesn't excite me. But what really excites me is knowing that some of the kids that I've met in a refugee camp could well be the last generation of kids to grow up in a refugee camp, that no other generation has to go through the just horrendous circumstances in which I found them. That keeps me motivated at 8 p.m. on a Friday night doing my emails when I'd rather be out with my friends. And so I will talk about those kids on TV because I know that when I do so, I'm passionate. And hopefully people could pick up on that. But at the same time, I try and meet people where they are. And I know that for a lot of people, they didn't meet those kids. And who am I to lecture them? So they need more than that. If there's going to be a bit less money going into their kids' school because we need to send a little bit of money to prevent more refugees, well, they need to know that, and that needs to be explained. So I will make what I call the case of the heart, which is the moral case, and also the case of the head, which is, spend a little bit of money now, avoid spending more money in the future.
I think that's something that we often find when we talk to our audience that, there is that, okay, well, there is perhaps a commitment and you might call it a sacrifice or some sort of value you need to put into this, but in the long run, here's the, here's the end goal. Here's something you're going to be able to achieve. When I think about some personal conversations that I have, because I volunteered for a while at an asylum and immigration center in Birmingham, UK. I probably got to experience a different side of what you do, Ryan, in terms of seeing the people who've reached the UK shores. But for me, talking about the heart side of it only got you so far, as you said. And I think there's always more to be said that's more about, okay, well, here's how this could benefit everyone. Here's how this can definitely affect positive change. With the coalition, how do you align everyone that you work with to your vision?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I mean, just on that asylum concept, I'd be actually interested, if we've got time, we're interested to know a bit more about your experience there, because that's really at the coalface of it, which is something it's a bit domestically in the UK, is not something I've done, but I probably ought to. But I think, to answer your question, aligning others to my vision is a work in progress, so I would not claim to have this cracked, but some broad sort of angles that I come at it from. I think the passion and authenticity that I've spoken about has to be retained. And I think so much of my job is it's fairly administrative, right? I mean, we have to recruit people, we have to make sure that the bills are paid, we have to make sure that our funders are happy, that my board, are pleased with me, otherwise I get sacked. And actually making time for that passion and remembering why you're doing it is absolutely key, because I just can't assume that others get that. So I need to be communicating that all the time. I think finding common ground is really important as well. You have to work in partnership in the nonprofit sector. It's an ecosystem. There are unlikely bedfellows. You've got to try and meet people where they are. So I try and be passionate, but I'm also dealing with people that don't particularly care. They've got their own motives. We can work together. That's okay. I try and be humble as well. And I think, if I'm being honest, I mean, people might laugh at this now because it sounds absolutely ridiculous, like a humble brag, if that's the right phrase. But I was probably a little bit too humble when I started because I felt insecure in what I was doing because it was a big promotion when I got this job. But I try to be humble now in a different way because, I'm standing on the shoulders of giants in many regards. Like people like, I mean, I've had a pop at Bono a minute ago, but to be fair to Bono, he was talking about this before I was born, before it was popular. And there are unsung heroes up and down the country who will volunteer in their Oxfam charity shop and do the real graft, we are where we are because they've done that work and they've put that shift in and they're still doing it. So I think that's important. And for all the work that I'm doing, Save the Children and Christian Aid and CAFOD have people in war zones, literally. So it's, yeah, I think acknowledging that is always really important. But I think from a organizational perspective, I've always tried to sweat the small stuff, like recruitment, I take really, really seriously. I know of some CEOs who, when they get to, where they are, they sort of delegate this sort of thing. I think you've really got to, in my experience, how do you get people to align with your vision? Well, hire the people that align with your vision, and then you can save yourself a lot of hassle further down the line. So that's important. And I think being honest about when things go wrong is important too, because then I think that serves two purposes. The first thing is it stops me and it stops my colleagues from creating a narrative in our heads that everything's going fine, and then waking up one morning to discover that it's all rubbish. If you can be honest in the short term, you can it therefore improve the further down you go, and not buy into, not believe your own spin, as it were, being really honest. And I think from an outside perspective, people know when you're claiming credit for stuff that's not yours. People know when something's not really worked. So I think just being honest and sort of saying, look, we tried this, actually it was a disaster, but that's not a bad thing. We thought it was worth trying. We don't regret it, but next year we're going to do something else. I think people get that. So yeah, I think there's a lot in there, I appreciate, but it's a big and important question.
It is, and it makes me reflect on season one of the podcast, where we spoke to a Hoshin Kanri practitioner called Frederick Fjellstedt, and he talked about how it's so important to have your values set at the start whenever you set about any sort of strategy, whether personal or business or something in terms of it's charitable. If you don't have that direction from the start, then everything else that flows, whether it is an initiative, whether it is just having a meeting, or it's hiring people, you're always going to have a misalignment. And just what you were saying there, Ryan, made me reflect immediately upon what Frederick said, and also the fact that, admitting when things perhaps haven't worked and owning up to it. And I think that's so important for anyone in terms of personal or professional. It's important to try and try and try, but it's okay to fail, as Samuel Beckett said. How do you keep track of the buy-in of people around you to your vision? Is it something to do with, okay, well, I know that I've recruited five people and I can see that they're going out and making this impact? Is there a way that you personally keep track of that sort of, it's a bit crude to call it a metric because this is such a meaningful endeavor that you're undertaking, but is there a way that you keep track of it?
Such a great question. I mean, so we have formal appraisals, all of that sort of thing, like fairly structured management system. We're a startup, I guess, but we've gone, we're over 5 years old, so we've now got policies and bureaucracy and stuff like that, which is right. It's always a bit of tension in terms of let's just get on with it, but actually he's probably right that we have some more structure. So we've got those policies, but I think I know it when I see it, if that makes sense. So for example, I was in Zambia last week with a very senior politician, and I was with two of my colleagues, and we flew to Zambia at 7 o'clock on a Sunday night. We flew to Dubai, took 7 hours. We then had a 3 hour layover. We then flew from Dubai to Lusaka, and then we went straight into the field to meet individuals who were working with young people who needed vaccinating from malaria and certain diseases. Basically, it was quite tough. It was traumatic and it was exhausting. And this comes at the end of a long year where, like everyone, we're all tired to get to this point. And my colleagues hadn't slept on the plane. They told me that. They said they tried, they hadn't succeeded. I like to think I'm fairly healthy and fit. I was running on empty, right? If I was a boxer, they would have thrown in the towel because I couldn't defend myself. That's how tired I was. Anyway, that night, the senior politician who had slept on the plane, so was tired but was feeling okay, stayed up late into the night. Well, she wanted to chat. She wanted to have a good conversation, all this. I found out the next day that my two colleagues had stayed up till 1 in the morning talking with her. And two things struck me. The first thing was they didn't tell me. So they didn't come to me looking for credit. They didn't say anything. I found out from the politician's advisor. And the second thing that struck me was they must have been absolutely out on their feet, to use another boxing analogy. But they did it. And they did it because that time spent with that individual to talk to them about what they'd seen, what they'd learned, things they could take away, it's just amazing. So that suggests to me that they'd gone well and truly above and beyond, and therefore were fully aligned with what we're trying to achieve. And there's countless examples of that I could speak to with my colleagues. And sometimes they're not quite as clear cut. I mean, there are occasions where it's not quite as dramatic in terms of how it can be related, but I know that they're doing it. It's the colleague who when I WhatsApp on a Sunday morning, which does not happen, just to be clear, at all often, but occasionally there is an emergency, just straight away just calls, and we can all glance at WhatsApp and think, sod that, it's Sunday morning, that can wait. But actually they pick up the phone, and I like to think that's not because I've got an atmosphere of fear where people think, oh my God, I must call. It's because people think, what can I do? What can I do? This isn't just about a job. This is about, succeeding in our mission.
Relationships clearly are very important to this role. And from the examples you've just given, it sounds like you have people around you that do align to your vision, Ryan, and they feel passionate about making a difference. What are some of the challenges of building that team, though? And how did you build external alliances and relationships that underpin the efforts of the coalition?
Yeah, I think so. I was quite fortunate in some ways because when I joined, there were, I think, four members of staff, including me. Two left during the transition period. I like to think that wasn't because I was coming in and they thought, let's get out quick before he starts. But I think it was, just coincidence. So I had an opportunity to recruit two new people. The two people that stayed were fantastic, but I had a chance to sort of bring in a couple of people who I knew. Well, not necessarily who I knew, but who I could interview and sort of suss out, as it were. And then we're now on 13 members of staff, including myself. So I've had a hand in recruiting all of them. So I've been quite fortunate. I think that's not typical. I think people come in and they inherit a team and they have to they inherit the culture of the team as well, which is a challenge if they then want to change that culture. Whereas I could sort of establish a culture to some extent. I've always looked for people who, when there's a challenge or a problem, don't sort of come running to their colleagues or superiors and say, "There's a problem, help." Although at an early stage in a career, that's totally normal, and I was also that person. I've tended to sort of go for people who say, "Do you know what? There was a disaster, but don't worry, I've got a plan." And even if that plan turns out to be rubbish, the fact that they've just got initiative and an eagerness to try and tackle it, that always strikes a chord with me. And you mentioned, James, about working in grocery, in sort of retail, at the beginning. I just think those skills are priceless and so undervalued in the sect in work. I mean, I'm sure you could speak to this too, but when I was washing up, basically it worked like this. The head chef would say to me, "Here's a load of pile of washing up. It's now 10:30 in the evening because we stopped serving food at 10. We're not paying you past 11:30. They were only paying me £3 an hour anyway, so I never quite work out why that was a big deal. But anyway, they said, "We're not paying you past 11:30. And also, I just want you out of the kitchen at midnight because I've got to close up, you know." And so I just had to get on with it and just find a way through. And I think people that have had those sorts of jobs and people that have worked in retail or people that have worked in the public, that's just something they've got. You just got to get on with it. And so, yeah, I've always basically tried to recruit people who, if they haven't got those skills, which is fine, have got that mindset. And I've been really fortunate in the people that have come on board.
Yeah, I think your pay wasn't too far off mine,
No.
and washing up was also part of my responsibilities. So I
Right.
think we have far more in common than we realize, Ryan.
Excellent.
I like that. I like that, and I agree with that because that's again something that I know I do. I know that my colleagues do when they look to build out their teams, and even I think even in sort of personal relationships, it's important to find people that maybe don't fully see things the same way as you, but they have the raw the raw resources to be able to be able to achieve something that means that okay, I might not believe in A, but I do believe in B, but I have this thing underneath me that means that if A is what we need to achieve, then that's what we'll do. In terms of your leadership style, you mentioned earlier about sort of imposter syndrome. What are the steps that you would suggest to someone who has that feeling moving into a more senior role? And there are plenty of people listening that they come to us, they come for educational resource in order to be able to move forward in their career. What would you advise to people who might feel that imposter syndrome once they get into a more senior position?
Yeah, I think yeah, so I think that thing about the senior position is really important, because I think so look, there's the obvious sort of stuff that someone eager to tackle this will have already done. So you Google it, you get some self-help books, you do all that good stuff. I think that's good. I think that's a really good starting point. But as you say, when you get into that senior position, you've probably typically done all of that, or you've exhausted all the self-help sections in the local bookshop. So I think first of all, I think there has to be an acknowledgement that this is hard. This is just difficult, and there's no silver bullet. I mean, if there is, I'd love to have it, but I haven't found it. So I think you have to be really, really honest with yourself, and for some that might be looking quite deeply in the mirror. I think stuff like therapy is something that ought to be considered. If there's stuff that is going on in your head that's holding you back, the smart thing to do is, and the mature thing to do is to really explore whether that needs a professional sort of support. I think on a slightly different level, career coaching is really worthwhile thinking about too. It's pricey. I've been really fortunate to have had access to it through my employer, and I'm a big fan of it. It may not work for everyone, but it gave me a lot of support too. So I think those are things worth considering. But I think in my own case, the thing that helped most of all was acknowledging that I didn't need to be perfect. And James, we spoke like before this started recording about getting things wrong when we're presenting. So, and I think we both, another similarity between us is we both maybe, we take pride in, communicating, and when it doesn't go right, maybe we give ourselves a hard time. Well, I know I do.
I
And
do.
the biggest thing that I learned was just sort of just, look, you got a presentation to give, you got a speech to give, think about it, prepare for it, rehearse for it. But if it doesn't go quite as you want it to go, well, that's because you're human. If you're a smart person and you've done your research and you've done your prep and you put time in and it still doesn't go right, I mean, what more could you have reasonably done? Okay, maybe you could have done three times as much prep, three times as much rehearsal, but then it sounds robotic and you lose that connection with the audience. So I think acknowledging that stuff will just not always go the way you want it to go. First of all, it's okay because we're human. And second of all, I think it's probably a good thing because it, on some level, the audience or the people you're trying to communicate with can relate to that. And I always come back to politics because it tends to be the area that I sort of work in, but I'll probably connect a lot more with a politician who's raw, a bit rough around the edges, than I would a slick, PR sort of, do you know what I mean? And I think that's borne out actually in opinion polls. If we look at someone like Jeremy Corbyn, just to be clear, not my politics, but no one could accuse him of being scripted and robotic, and he seemed to connect. And I know that would also have to do with with his policies and stuff like that. And the same could be said with plenty on the other side of the spectrum. So anyway, I think when it comes to imposter syndrome, there's no silver bullet. I think it's such a big problem. I think you have to consider getting some support if it's needed, but also nothing, no book and no external support will ever help you overcome the stuff that only you can sort of deal with. And for me, it was that perfectionism, and for others, it will be other stuff.
Thank you. So when you were just talking there, Ryan, you mentioned about having a way to connect with people. In terms of showing and the value of the work that you do to your different stakeholders, what are the ways that you normally go about doing that?
Yeah, so we have KPIs, we have deliverables that we have to hit. So for example, our funders might fund us to run an overseas visits program where we take policymakers to see UK aid in the field. They will fund us to write and publish research reports on various topics related to international development. There'll be other things too, programs and what have you, but if we don't do those things, we're in trouble because that's what we said we would do. And then within that, we sort of have our own measurements. So, okay, we've run a trip to Zambia, but I mean, that's not enough. How do we know it's worked? How do we know we've taken this policymaker to see this project? What if they come back and say, that's confirmed all my suspicions? Aid is wasted. It is a waste of time. We should be spending it on the UK domestic sector. So how do we make sure that that's not the case? And so we'll have KPIs to make sure that we're being really honest with ourselves. So does that policymaker come back, give an interview to the press, and write an op-ed for their local newspaper saying, I went and saw this and development is really important? If they have, we'll give ourselves a tick. If they haven't, we'll give ourselves a question mark. And if they come back and say, I don't ever want to see that stuff again, then we know we screwed up. Or perhaps we didn't screw up. Maybe it was just too difficult in this case. Now, it's far more nuanced. If any of my funders are listening to this, it's far more nuanced than that very crude sort of criteria. But that's broadly the gist of it. But I think that's always just one side, and this is my non-corporate background coming out now. But I also know if it's worked, and I think it's we're quite fortunate in our line of work if it's worked or not, because you sort of know if someone's met a group of children and what they've said has affected them, they will typically, demonstrate that in their body language and their actions. And I'm not very emotive by nature, but even I can sort of tell when someone's affected and when they're not. So we'll have that too. But I think ultimately, I'm always really hard on us about getting results. And even if we're ticking all these metrics, hitting all these KPIs, getting lots of media, it's all for nothing if we don't succeed. And in 5 years' time, or maybe 10 years, you know, politics is hard to predict, but we have to get to a point where international development is no longer the default thing the government cuts whenever time gets tough. It has to be like the NHS, it has to be like the Ministry of Defence budget. It's an integral part of our well-being and our safety and our security and our health as a nation. Has to get to that point. And if it doesn't, and we'll know if we're getting there or not, but if it's not going in that direction, then it doesn't matter how many KPIs we hit. You know, we need to own up to that and work out what to do next.
I think that's really useful for anyone listening because, with corporate mindset, it's normally what is the ROI? What is the can we see it in the balance sheet? Are we seeing improvements on the shop floor? What Ryan's talking about for our listeners is pretty similar to doing a Gemba walk of going onto the production floor and seeing that one thing that we targeted as an improvement priority hasn't made an impact. We can only really know by getting down into, the trenches and actually experiencing firsthand what that impact is with our own two eyes. And I think that is really important for people listening to know that it's more than a dollar amount. It's sometimes just knowing yourself by seeing whatever that thing is that you're trying to address. Ryan, I could keep talking for a very long time, but I know that you are a very, very busy person. And from what we've been hearing today, it's obviously for a very good purpose why you're very busy. I wanted to just bring today's episode to a close. But before I did that, I wanted to just give you the opportunity to share any sort of information that you might have to, for anyone who might want to help raise awareness or support the coalition.
Yeah, sure. And if I can, I'll squeeze in social mobility as well, because I see them as two sides of the same coin. I think in terms of helping the coalition, as I said earlier, we work with policymakers, and if there's any policymakers or politicians listening, then I mean, I'd love to hear from them. But if it's people not in that category, all I would ask is the next time you read a story in a newspaper about how aid is squandered and stuff like that, I would just say, no one is more upset and more angry than people that work in international development, because we'll have typically met the individuals who need it and who, if that story is correct, have not got it. I would also add that, you know, if we cut the Ministry of Defence budget every time there was a procurement scandal, we'd have no armed forces left. So actually, while I'm not excusing any waste of money when it comes to aid, this isn't just restricted to aid, and I'm not having a pop at the MOD either. You could talk about welfare, you could talk about any aspect of government spending. So I would just ask that everyone keeps that in mind. And finally, on social mobility, I would just, you know, if you come from a background which is not your typical route into whatever profession you're in, so basically, if you're the first to go to university in your family, or you come from a pretty ropey sort of area, please talk about it. I think the more people that talk about it, the more normal it becomes, and that really helps. And if you've been to Eton and been raised in a mansion, that's also fine. You know, you deserve great success as well. But also, please talk about social mobility, because that also really helps. So that's my combined plea, if that's all right.
No, absolutely, Ryan. I think it nicely summarizes today's episode, and I just wanted to thank you for being our strategy hero for today's episode. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. And if you do want to learn more about Ryan, you can find him on LinkedIn. There will be a link in the description of this podcast. So again, Ryan, thank you so much for joining us, and everyone. That's Ryan Henson, who has been our strategy hero for the day. Thank you, Ryan.
Thank you. Pleasure. Thanks so much.